This is Wayne Wagner for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is designed for a print and visually impaired audience. We left off with Craig Brown's visit with Governor Hunt regarding his possible appointment to the bench. We pick up in Chapter 6. Our interview closed with a thorough discussion of how I would be efficient as a blind judge in a courtroom setting. I explained to the governor that I had seriously considered that question since January 1996 when I made a decision to seek Judge Manson's seat in the May 1998 primary. I had spent 2.5 days in the district courtrooms of Durham County watching the proceedings and determining in my own mind how I would handle similar situations. Before I announced my candidacy for judge, I had to convince myself that I would be able to do the job. I was so convinced. As Brian and I left the interview, stepped down the Capitol steps, and moved back toward our car, we saw one of my opponents whizzing past us. I greeted her. She indicated that she was late. We then went back to Durham, and later I joined my family over at Mom's house in American Village. As I got home that night and climbed the steps to my front door, I stopped and began to cry. I asked God why he had put me through this horrible crucible that day. Why had I lost my sight, my marriage, and my mother in the last 6 months? What was the point, I wondered? What was the point? I was exhausted from the day's events and went to bed. Later the next morning, I received a telephone call from my old college friend Jim Phillips, who was an attorney with a major law firm in Greensboro, North Carolina. He served as Governor Hunt's finance chairman in 1992 and now served as his legislative counsel. Jim explained that he had spoken with Governor Hunt regarding my appointment. He then told me the rest of my opponent's story. As it turned out, she was 1 hour and 10 minutes late for her interview with the governor. Needless to say, this is not something that one does. After she explained her lateness, I am told the governor made the following statement to open the interview. Mr. Brown is blind, and his mother died today. Nevertheless, he was half an hour early for his interview. I do not find your explanation compelling. According to Jim, as well as the governor, she had an interview that qualified only as an unmitigated disaster. There is no way that Governor Hunt would appoint her as a district court judge, said Phillips. You are in the catbird seat, and you should be exceedingly optimistic. The statutory time period for the governor to make his decision was fast approaching an end. The expiration date was September 30th, 1996. As the time drew nearer, I could only wish that Governor Hunt would make up his mind so that I could go on with my life. Chapter 7. The Call to Public Service. September 30th, 1996 was a typical Indian summer day in North Carolina. The weather was warm, the sun was shining, and the birds were chirping. I was taking full advantage of the beautiful weather as I caned my way down 4 blocks on Main Street to the courthouse. Over the years, I had traveled this way many times before. I said hello to the various proprietors on the street as I caned my way past them, although my thoughts were focused on the criminal cases that were on the criminal trial calendar that week. But today was also Judgment Day. In North Carolina, when a judge vacates his position during a term, the local bar votes on his replacement. Exactly this had happened in Durham, and 3 good lawyers were still in the race. Ann McCown, a former assistant district attorney who now focused on domestic law, was the front runner. Then there was I, and then Marcia Morey, an assistant district attorney who specialized in juvenile matters and founded Teen Court, an alternative program for youthful offenders. Ann crushed me in the bar vote, where I finished second. McCown, 242 votes, Brown, 152, and Morey, 136 votes. Unless Governor Hunt named his own selection, the first-place finisher would automatically be named to the bench. Governor Hunt was no ordinary state governor. He had first served as governor of North Carolina from 1977 to 1985, then again from 1993 to 2001. Simply put, Hunt was and is a consummate political animal with broad knowledge of the issues, people, and politics and history of North Carolina. A native of Rocky Mount, he had previously served as lieutenant governor prior to being elected governor. I first met him in the spring of my freshman year at UNC Chapel Hill. I voted for him then and every time thereafter. Hunt was an impressive man. I never knew Governor Hunt to avoid making any decision. We'd all hear who his judge selection was today, September 30th. My first stop was Durham County Superior Criminal Court to hear the criminal calendar call, which would tell us when our cases were to be heard that week. We all stood up as Chief Resident Superior Court Judge Orlando Hudson, Jr. came to his bench at the front of the courtroom. Oyez! 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 Intoned the bailiff. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Superior Court of Durham County, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now in session. God save the state and this honorable court. As then District Attorney Jim Hardin began to announce the day's schedule, I suddenly felt a slight tug on my left shoulder. I turned to my left. It was Myrtle Weaver, the chief clerk in Superior Court. "Myrtle, what do you want? I'm a little busy right now," I whispered to her. "Craig, the governor is on the phone, and he wants to talk to you." I think that she whispered loud enough so that everyone around me could hear. "The governor?" I whispered back. I grabbed my cane and followed Myrtle to her office behind the courtroom, a distance of about 30 feet. As we took the short walk, I realized that I was getting nervous. A gaggle of attorneys and onlookers were hanging around outside her door, and as I picked up the receiver, I heard the shuffle of 10 of my colleagues as they followed me into Myrtle's office. "Hello, this is Craig Brown." "Mr. Brown, this is Governor Hunt. I am seriously considering appointing you as a district court judge, but before I do that, we need to have this conversation." Yes, sir, I replied, hoping that my voice wasn't shaking. "Mr. Brown, I was concerned about your toughness during our interview," the governor began. "Being a judge not only takes the ability to be fair, but also at times being tough, too." "Well, I understand that, sir," I said. "It may have seemed that during our interview I responded to questions with a less than tough demeanor, but if you remember, sir, my mother had passed away the night before our interview," I explained. Silence. I suppose the governor was considering my response. Quickly, I added, "I'll be tough but fair if you decide to appoint me." "That's all I can expect of my judges," the governor responded, and then proceeded to review with me my opponents, my supporters, and the people who had said they were my supporters but really weren't. I'll never reveal the latter list. I found the last category to be the most interesting, but on the other hand, I figured that since this was politics, why should I believe anybody? He mentioned two of my supporters in particular, Jim Phillips, the governor's legislative counsel, and Travis Porter, the governor's chief supporter in Durham County. I had known both men for a long time. Jim and I went to school at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We were both heavily involved in student politics. Jim had been elected student body president at Carolina in 1978, and I was his chief assistant. I joined his fraternity, Chi Psi, as a senior. I had known Travis Porter since college as well, but in a different way. Porter was a powerful attorney in Durham County, having built the largest local law firm in the city. In his spare time, Porter also served as chairman of the Board of Trustees at the University of North Carolina and chairman of the Board of Governors of the UNC system. His son Greg was one of my best friends at Carolina. The Porter family took this out-of-state student from Iowa under their wing. We would go over to the Porter house in Durham on some weekends during the school year to eat or watch basketball or football games. I got to know the whole Porter family well, his mother Jane and his two brothers Daryl and Chris. Travis Porter was simply bigger than life. He had a booming voice, and like me, he liked to talk about his experiences, his life, and the people he came in contact with, good or bad. I suppose ex-Marines are like that. His favorite quote was, "Another day, another chance to excel." I rather liked that, too. Later, I was told that Travis made his final phone call to the governor, supporting me from his hospital bed in one of the recovery rooms at Duke Hospital. He had just undergone a quadruple heart bypass. The story is true, and it fits him to a T. Governor Hunt continued, "You have a fine professional record, Mr. Brown. You have a lot to do in your life. As a judge, you've got to remember that every person who appears in front of you is a citizen and should be treated with respect." "Yes, sir. I thank you, sir. I will," I responded to the governor. The governor wasn't quite finished. "You have one other problem, Mr. Brown."
"What is it?" I asked the governor nervously.
"You talk too much."
Choosing my words carefully, I responded slowly, succinctly. "I've never been in public life, Governor. Keeping my counsel is something I'll have to learn.
I hate judges who get big heads. I hope you won't be that kind of judge."
No, sir.
"Good. Mr. Brown, I'm pleased to appoint you as the district court judge for the 14th Judicial District."
My chest was pounding.
"Thank you, Governor." And so, I became the fourth blind judge in the 350-year history of North Carolina, as one of about three dozen blind judges in the United States. I was overwhelmed and elated. As I hung up the phone, I turned around, raised my hand in the air, and took a high five for my good friend and campaign chairman, Brian Ayers. When my colleagues, who had crowded into Myrtle's office, gathered around to congratulate me, I realized my life was about to change again. At the time, I did not fully appreciate the powers that I had been given to change people's lives, a bully pulpit from which to change the status quo for the better, to punish the guilty with compassion and mercy. Of course, some people wouldn't deserve that. There would be cases yet to come where I would simply throw away the key. Chapter 8, The Judicial System. The criminal and civil justice system in North Carolina is pretty straightforward. There are three trial courts, magistrate court, district court, and superior court. On the appellate level, there is a North Carolina Court of Appeals and the North Carolina Supreme Court. Magistrate court handles civil matters of up to $5,000 in dispute and carries a substantial volume. Criminal magistrates handle the setting of bond, detainment after arrest, and have the authority to deal with Class 3 criminal misdemeanors and smaller traffic matters. Magistrates are not required to be lawyers. All criminal matters begin in district court, ranging from first-degree murder to second-degree trespass and everywhere in between. Serious felonies are transferred later to superior court by a grand jury indictment or bill of information. Felony matters can be subject to a jury trial. In terms of civil matters, district court handles all civil disputes of $5,000 to $25,000 and all domestic, juvenile, and Department of Social Services matters. District court handles most of all criminal and civil matters in North Carolina. District court judges must be lawyers and are elected every 4 years. If a district court judicial seat is vacated during the middle of the term, the replacement is chosen by gubernatorial decision after the local bar votes to select the top three candidates from their judicial district. The highest court, Superior Court, handles all serious felony matters and civil matters with more than $25,000 in dispute. All cases in Superior Court can be subject to a jury trial. In criminal Superior Court, like criminal district court, most criminal matters are disposed of by a plea agreement between the state and the defendant. In civil matters, in both district and superior court, a large number of civil cases are disposed of by settlement on mediation between the parties.
Superior Court judges are elected every 8 years and are in general more experienced than district court judges or moved up from district court thereafter. The judicial system is composed of many players with different roles. The players include the district attorney's office, which represents the state's interests and protects victims' rights in all criminal matters in both district and superior court. The public defender's office handles all indigent criminal cases in North Carolina, except where the defendant has hired his own private criminal lawyer or the public defender has a conflict of interest. To give you an example of conflict of interest, the public defender cannot represent a victim who then becomes a defendant on a different charge and the defendant in the victim's case. Such cases are transferred to private criminal lawyers who are on the indigent misdemeanor criminal list. The public defender is paid for by the state of North Carolina, but they represent criminal defendants individually. Most assistant district attorneys and assistant public defenders start at the least complicated level of district criminal court. There, they handle misdemeanor and low-level felony cases. Over time, they gain a considerable amount of trial experience and move up ultimately to criminal superior court as staff attorney vacancies allow. Inexperienced private criminal lawyers can handle misdemeanors immediately out of law school, but cannot be placed on the felony list until they have 2 years of criminal law experience. Death penalty lawyers are required to have a minimum of 5 years of criminal law experience. All civil and criminal courts in district and superior court and at the appellate level are required to have a bailiff and or deputy sheriff to help maintain security in the courtroom. When court dockets are crowded, the sheriff's office necessarily shifts its personnel around to enhance security in a crowded courtroom. The sheriff's department is also responsible for maintaining each county jail and the inmates in them. On the civil side, the sheriff's office is responsible for all service of civil papers when lawsuits begin in district and superior court. The sheriff's office also has law enforcement jurisdiction over the entire county, except where cities and towns have their own police department. The county sheriff in all 100 counties in North Carolina is elected every 4 years. In addition to maintaining order in the civil and trial courts, the sheriff's office also protects district and superior court judges, especially in situations where the judge has received a credible death threat. During my nearly 12 years on the district court bench, I received 3 death threats. As you might imagine, the Durham County Sheriff's Office was sometimes a little paranoid about protecting me since I am blind. For example, when a credible death threat was received, I was escorted by a deputy sheriff from my office to the courtroom and all places in between. In my experience, judges don't talk about receiving death threats very often. In very serious situations, the State Bureau of Investigation, SBI, can be called in to assist the protection of the threatened judge. To give you a concrete example of one such death threat, let me explain it to you. A father was in front of me for non-payment of child support when I presided over child support court. He contended that no order had been made determining child support. The attorney for the mother said otherwise, and I had my judicial assistant take a look at the court file, where he quickly found a child support order signed by one of my fellow judges. So, I told the father that there must have been a child support hearing, which is to determine child support, since there was a court order in the file to the same effect. Since he had failed to pay child support, I held him in contempt of court, and I sentenced him to 30 days active in the Durham County Jail. He then was overheard by another inmate at the jail threatening my life. I think he wrote me a letter to that effect, too, but I'm not sure about that. So a deputy sheriff began following me whenever I moved about the courthouse, even when I went to the bathroom. But I was curious as to why the father went to such great lengths, so I decided to look into it a bit further. Of course, since I received the death threat, I relieved myself from the father's case. I got one of my colleagues to listen to the tape recording of the child support proceedings, which had led to the judgment in the court file. She reported that another district court judge had heard that case admonished the mother's attorney for not being properly prepared and told him there was no way he could reach a child support decision with the little information he was given. He refused to issue an order. Well, the father's story was beginning to check out. From those facts, I believe that the mother's attorney submitted a false order to the district court judge who heard her case. They probably did so some weeks or months later, but when after a judge has heard so many matters in between, no one can remember all the facts of a case that was tried so much earlier. So he signed the order, because I'm sure he assumed that most lawyers realize they're under obligation, given the code of professional conduct, to submit accurate orders to the court. When I told the judge who tried the first case when the child support was supposed to be established about the discrepancy between the tape and the order, I really don't know if anything happened to the out-of-town attorney thereafter. Certainly, I thought that a state bar complaint was clearly in order, and that such a code violation might very well result in temporary suspension or even permanent disbarment. But I was not the right party to file such complaints. Yet even if there is no official action, there are a number of things a judge can do to an offending attorney. I discuss what occurred with every member of the Durham District Bench, as well as my friends, on the bench in neighboring counties. Lawyers should be aware that judges do discuss them from time to time. As a group, we have a pretty good idea of who to watch out for. As for the offending attorney in this case, I think she got the message. I rarely saw her in the Durham County Courthouse after that. The nerve center of all but 100 courthouses in North Carolina is the clerk's office, which handles all recording of all civil and criminal judgments, special proceedings, and estate matters. The clerk of court is elected every 4 years by the citizens of each county. In addition to the clerk of court, there are many deputy and assistant clerks in each county. Like magistrates, clerks of court are not required to be attorneys. Each county is individually responsible for building and maintaining their county courthouse and jail. All state employees in the judicial system are overseeing the administration of the courts. Very shortly after I passed the bar exam and was sworn in as a new attorney, the senior partner of my law firm, Marshall G. Spears, Jr., told me something about clerks that I never forget to this day. Always treat every clerk like they were your best friend. Why's that? I asked him. Mr. Spears smiled and thought for a moment. Well, because clerks can teach you a great deal about how to actually practice law. They can show you how to do the same thing more quickly. And if you make a mistake, they will help you correct it. In those same situations, if you have treated them brutally before, they will just tell you to have a nice day. The AOC is responsible for the handling of criminal and civil justice policies within the state and is overseen by a director. Judges vest judicial and retirement benefits over 5 years of service. For most state employees, they vest their retirement and health insurance after 30 years of service. Historically, the justice system in North Carolina has been seriously underfunded by the state legislature. Surprisingly, in light of the state's more progressive leanings compared to its southern counterparts, North Carolina ranks dead last in judicial funding when compared with the 50 states. By further example, the district court and superior court judges are paid the lowest amount in the southeastern United States. In my experience, state employees in the judicial system are not there for the money. We need an independent justice system in North Carolina that merits selection of all judges' retention elections in all judicial seats. This will help take the politics out of the judicial system process. Finally, the severely underfunded judicial system in North Carolina is in critical need of substantially greater funding by the legislature. Many veteran state employees are lost to the private sector, where their salaries are considered to be greater. Many clerks hold second or third jobs just to make ends meet. In my 25 years of legal experience, with 13 years being spent in the private bar and almost 12 years on a bench, I worked with literally hundreds of district attorneys, public defenders, sheriff's deputies, and clerks, as well as lawyers in Durham County. Even with different interests, the success of an effective judicial system is in the teamwork. Each judge is a part of the team and overseen by a chief judge in both district and superior courts. Since each judge is individually elected, I always compared getting judicial consensus with herding a group of cats. chapter 9, Taking the Bench and Moving On. Most of the people at the courthouse didn't know quite what to expect when I took the bench on October 28, 1996. In all honesty, I was not quite sure either, but I wanted to make the best of it. What kind of judge would I be? How would my blindness have an impact upon my ability to judge? When I came down to court that morning, I was confronted with a sea of delinquent child support cases, many attorneys, and a host of curious onlookers. As the clerk opened court, I heard the assembled crowd stand up. I remember thinking that it was rather sad that I could not see everybody stand up when I walked into the room. I sat down in the judge's chair behind the bench. I then took charge, believing that was what judges were usually supposed to do. I told everyone assembled how I intended to run court. I explained to them that the clerk would call the calendar since I could not. I suggested to them ways in which they could try their cases a little bit differently so as to accommodate my disability. When I finished, everyone was silent. I took that to mean that no one had any questions and that I was off and running as a district court judge. Henry Pruitt, an attorney for the Department of Social Services, broke the silence. Over time, I would learn that he was a deliberate and methodical attorney with a great dry sense of humor. He called the first case for trial, a child support case where the father had not made a payment in over 10 years. The child's mother took the stand and explained in no uncertain terms that her ex-husband was a no-good deadbeat. I interrupted her direct examination and remarked how well she had rolled her eyes back into her head. The courtroom fell quiet. You could hear a pin drop. How could a blind man, let alone a judge, know that she had rolled her eyes into the back of her head? I could tell by the inflection in her voice. I knew that her eyes had rolled. On good days, I could even hear witnesses breathing on the witness stand. It is true, when you lose one sense, the other senses become much more acute. At that moment, I began to perceive that my blindness was not always a disability. Just like any other disability, blindness is a major hindrance sometimes. But I've come to realize that most of the time, my disability can be successfully accommodated. And at the same time, I believe that many of the sighted onlookers in that courtroom that morning began to see that disabilities can be overcome. As I lost my sight over the years, I still knew that it was important to look someone in the eyes when speaking to them. I learned the dimensions of every room that I entered so I could scan the room when I spoke. I learned to look people in the eye by hearing where their voice came from and shifting my eyes several inches upward towards the sound of their voice, especially when they were right next to me or at a conference table in a meeting. When I was on the bench as a judge, I also knew the bench was higher than people that were standing before me, so I adjusted my approach toward their direction. I wasn't perfect, but I got close. Sometimes, to make the sighted more comfortable about my blindness, I had to use mannerisms of the sighted. Making a civil or criminal judgment is a step-by-step process. Any judge must first listen to the evidence very carefully. As a blind jurist, I listen carefully to the tone, inflection, cadence, and consistency of the story. Put another way, lies fit the facts perfectly, but the truth was usually a bit messier. After hearing the evidence, a judge then applies the law by the weight of the evidence. In civil cases, this means determining whether a party has proved cause of action. In criminal cases, the question is whether the state has proved the elements of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. Once the judge considers the law after hearing the evidence, he or she then issues a judgment or decision in a given case. Judges are a product of their accumulative life experience. Where they were born, where they went to school, the type of law that they practiced, as well as their family, friends, and colleagues, are all part of the making of a judge. The nature of the person shapes judicial temperament and demeanor. Every judge is different. Throughout my life, I have been blessed with a wicked sense of humor. Over the years, I have increasingly taken to laughing at myself. After all, one should never take oneself too seriously, especially if one is judge. A judge is not the center of a courtroom. Justice is. In my second week on the bench, I presided over Durham County Criminal Court. Much of my experience as a lawyer has been spent in criminal court, so I felt entirely comfortable there. On the afternoon of my second day, a female defendant took the stand, pleading not guilty to a charge of simple assault. As she took the stand and sat down in the witness chair, she yelled her name into the microphone. I asked her to be quiet. She responded by yelling her version of the story into the microphone. I asked her again to be quiet. She continued in the same loud fashion. "Ma'am," I told her, "I may be blind, but as of yet, I'm not deaf." The courtroom roared. "It is important to have a sense of humor about everything, even your Achilles heel." Crime, poverty, and racism are ever-present in our society, especially in our criminal justice system. I despise racism the most because it is so stupid and so self-destructive. It is no surprise, then, that I confronted racism full front from my first week in criminal court. District court is the first trial level of our court system in North Carolina. As such, almost all trials are conducted by a judge rather than a jury. In the case before me, both parties had charged the other with simple assault. In legal terms, this is known as a cross-warrant situation. One defendant was black, the other was white. The white defendant was a Durham storekeeper in his early 30s. For purpose of this story, I will call him Mr. Williams. The black defendant was a long-distance truck driver, and I will call him Mr. Smith. Mr. Williams was the owner of a small hardware store in Durham County. As part of his business, Mr. Williams repaired lawnmower tires and other such things. Mr. Smith came to his store that morning seeking to have a lawnmower tire fixed. Mr. Smith explained to the storekeeper that he was in a hurry, so he would appreciate it if he would turn his attention directly to the tire. Mr. Williams did so. Unfortunately for Mr. Williams, he found that removing the tire from the hub was extremely difficult. In fact, he tried twice unsuccessfully to remove the tire, injuring himself and swearing in the process. As he looked on, Mr. Smith found Mr. Williams' unsuccessful efforts to be quite funny. He snickered at Mr. Williams. At this point, not only had Mr. Williams failed to remove the tire successfully from the hub, he had hurt himself, and he was being laughed at. Mr. Williams became quite angry and strode over to where Mr. Smith was standing, watching him. He took the tire with him, pulled it up to his chest, and basically threw it at Mr. Smith. The force of the tire hitting his chest drove Mr. Smith backwards, and he fell over several trash cans. As Mr. Smith bounced back up from the floor, he came at Mr. Williams. "Nigger," Mr. Williams yelled at him, and a general melee quickly ensued. Two young black men stepped into the middle of the fight to break it up. They were successful, and the fight was over shortly. Sometimes the best thing about being a district court judge is that you can yell at both sides. This was one of those cases. I acquitted Mr. Smith of a simple assault charge, finding that he had exercised reasonable self-defense. But I was not done there. I also told him that his attitude in that store was not right, since Mr. Williams was simply trying to do the best that he could in fixing his tire, even if it was unsuccessful. Laughing at somebody never accomplishes very much, I told him. I found Mr. Williams guilty of simple assault. However, since he had no criminal history, I granted him a prayer for judgment, continued upon payment of court costs and reimbursement of the unpaid medical bills incurred by Mr. Smith. But I wasn't done there either. I told Mr. Williams that the client was always right. I told him that use of the N-word was entirely inappropriate. And if he did not believe me, I reminded him that one-third of the citizens of Durham were black, and he needed their business. Unless he wanted to write off one-third of the county as his customers, he would do well to change his attitude. I don't know if what I said to Mr. Smith or Mr. Williams had any lasting impact upon them, but racism of any kind needs to be confronted directly. When racism is brought out into the open, I believe that it is often seen for what it is: stupid blindness. The next day, I was confronted with my first direct taste of racism in my court. A young black man was charged with driving with a revoked license and resisting a public officer. Apparently, as he was backing out of his driveway, he caused an accident. He called the police to notify them of the accident, forgetting that he had no license in the process. Of course, when the police arrived, they asked him for his license, and he had none. He then went back into his house looking for the driver's license he knew he did not have. By the time he returned to the street in front of his house, the police officer had determined that his license had been revoked. As a result, he wanted to place the same defendant who had called in the accident under arrest for driving while his license was revoked. The defendant did not like this change of circumstances, and he refused to put his hands behind his back so he could be arrested. Using Rambo tactics, the police officer then responded to this defiance by placing the defendant's head into the concrete of the street. You can imagine the scene. White police officer forcing head of black man into the street in a predominantly black neighborhood. By this time, two other white police officers had arrived on the scene, and some curious neighbors had decided to come out of their homes to see what was up. One of those curious neighbors was the defendant's mother, who lived next door. She ran across her lawn toward the defendant's car, where the defendant was now face first on the street. Police officers took her down to the ground, too. When Grandma came running out to see what was happening, she only got within about 10 feet of her grandson when another police officer took her to the ground as well. Turned out, Grandma was 71 years old. The traffic citation had turned into something clearly more. I then learned that the young black man had a promising future. He was employed by a local bank, and he was pursuing his education. He had no prior criminal history. I dismissed the resisting a public officer charge because I thought the police had done an excellent job of overreacting to the situation. Put another way, there is no way that a 71-year-old grandmother, the mother, and a young black man need to end up on the ground in this case. With respect to the driving while license revoked charge, since the defendant had paid off the ticket that caused his license to be revoked, I found him guilty but gave him a prayer for judgment continued. After I had been on the bench for about 4 months, it was a bright, sunny Sunday afternoon. While judges are not supposed to work on Sunday, we are on call 24 hours a day. This Sunday was especially busy, since the phone rang with my third phone call from the Durham County Jail that day. Magistrate Chet Dobbies was on the phone yet again, and I decided that I needed to have some fun. "Magistrate Dobbies," I asked, "why are you bothering me again?" Dobbies chuckled, pausing a bit. "Magistrate Dobbies," I asked, "where are Judge Titus, Judge Cheney, Judge O'Neill, and Judge Johnson this weekend?" They were the other district court judges in Durham County at the time. Magistrate Dobbies chuckled again, a little bit louder. "I don't know," he responds. "Y'all just think that a blind judge is always going to be at home, do you?" I asked. By this time, Magistrate Dobbies was beginning to hoot. "You know, Magistrate Dobbies," I continued, "I have been a college freshman, a first-year law student, a first-year associate, and a junior partner." I explained those situations. Magistrate Dobbies could barely contain his laughter at this point. "I am 40 years old now and don't need to do that over again." By now, Magistrate Dobbies had almost fallen off his chair with laughter. As he regained his composure, there was a brief silence, then he said, "Your Honor, life sure does suck sometimes, doesn't it?" And he broke into laughter yet again. One of my favorite lawyers in Durham County is James D. Butch Williams. I had watched Butch practice law my entire career. He is one of our finest criminal defense lawyers, and he's extremely good on his feet. I had listened to him making closing arguments in a multitude of criminal cases over the years. Since I knew most of his stock closing by heart, I must confess that I was lying in wait for him for nearly 7 months while I was on the bench. Butch was representing a defendant who was charged with driving while impaired. The defendant's vehicle, which he confessed he was operating, had gone off the road and crashed. The vehicle had a car phone in it, and when police arrived at the scene, no one was present. A 911 call located the driver some 5 blocks from the scene, and police arrived to investigate. The driver appeared to be intoxicated when he was visited by the police, and after he admitted he was driving, the police arrested him for driving while impaired. Butch was attempting to suppress evidence of his client's confession. Butch came to the podium armed with his usual adamant verbal ammunition. He began his closing as he usually did, explaining in a few sentences why the motion to suppress should be allowed. Butch then said, As Your Honor can see from the whites of my client's eyes, this was the stock phrase that I'd been waiting for. I had heard it my entire career. I shot back, Mr. Williams, if I could see the whites of your client's eyes, it would be a miracle. The courtroom exploded into a riotous laughter. My legal assistant, Sharon Giddin, told me later that Butch never knew of his mistake until I pounced on it. The words were out of his mouth before he realized to whom he was speaking. As he stood at the podium in a sea of laughter, Bush covered his eyes, then looked through them and covered them again. It is the only time that I have ever known Butch Williams to forget his closing argument. I believe now that the laughter that morning was not at me or at Mr. Williams, but at my circumstance. We were no longer laughing at my blindness. We were laughing at the inability of sighted people to deal with it. Finally, after 20 years, I'd begun once again to come full circle. So, armed with the confidence of challenges met and embraced by the joy of laughter in the human spirit, the road, my road, was once again open. With a fork behind me, the sun on my back, and the warm breeze in my face, I moved forward into my future. And so should we all. Chapter 10, Five Hearings. The controversies presented in the courtroom are a mirror of those in our society. Surprisingly, the issue of gay rights, warrantless searches, and gut instincts were almost par for the course, even in district court. In 1990, the Hispanic population in Durham was slightly above zero. Today, it is slightly more than 12% of Durham's overall population. This Spanish influx has had a dramatic and substantial impact upon the court system here. In my experience, the Hispanic population generally does not understand or trust the American court system. They do not understand our history, our constitution, our institutions, and our laws. Some of the laws here are very different from what they would be in Latin America. When it comes to the Hispanic culture, we Anglos don't do much better. We don't understand their culture any better than they understand ours. We have a lot of work to do. The next case underscores some of the impacts of the dramatic growth in the Hispanic population as shown in Espinoza versus Nash. In this case, I was called upon as a district court judge to understand the history and cultures of Ecuador. This case is a sign that North Carolina is changing and our court system needs to change with it. Espinoza versus Nash. I heard the Espinoza versus Nash case in 2004. Durham lawyers Joanne Foyle and Paul Brock represented the parties. They both did a superb job. The case lasted parts of about 19 different days, with the chief issues being child custody and visitation. In more recent years, I believe it was the longest such domestic trial. The Espinozas and the Nashes were grandparents of a 3-year-old child named Destiny, born on Christmas Day, 2001. Her father, the Espinoza's son, had died in an automobile accident. Destiny's mother was the daughter of the Nashes. Unfortunately, because of health problems, she was not fit or proper to have custody of Destiny. The Espinozas were citizens of Ecuador. Mr. Paul Espinoza, the paternal grandfather, was a doctor there. I don't recall what Mrs. Susan Espinoza did. Mr. Nash played a major role in building an asbestos removal firm to the largest business of its kind in Durham County. Mrs. Nash was a homemaker. As a result of her father's death, Destiny was the beneficiary of a substantial workers' compensation settlement, as well as monthly Social Security benefits. Unlike most domestic cases, there were plenty of resources here with which to raise the child. Whoever got Destiny got the money. But as the trial proceeded, I sensed that neither party was really focusing on that at all. Since the trial went on for days, I'll skip giving you a blow-by-blow account of the testimony of both parties. By the end of the trial, I had concluded that both the Espinozas and the Nashes were fit and proper people to have custody over Destiny. But Destiny had been born in the United States. She did not understand Spanish. If she stayed in Durham, her mother might be able to see her from time to time. So I gave the Nashes primary custody of Destiny, but I provided for substantial international visitation for the Espinozas. destiny was also to learn Spanish. I directed that the parties each have a computer set up with audio and video capabilities so that Destiny could talk to her grandparents in Ecuador when she was in North Carolina, and vice versa. If I remember correctly, I even dictated a trust for Destiny's benefit with suggestions on how to invest and spend her monthly income. It was truly a fascinating case. Since that time, I understand that the Espinosas have seen Destiny regularly. Destiny's grandparents, the Espinosas and the Nashes, are working together to raise her. Destiny is 7 years old now, growing like a weed, and a good student, too, from what I've been told. Sometimes domestic cases can work out. Montaldo versus Voorhees. The plaintiff, Mr. Montaldo, was an American citizen who fathered a daughter out of wedlock with the defendant, Miss Voorhees, who was a citizen and resident of Guatemala. Shortly after the birth of their daughter, Montaldo brought her to the United States and settled in his hometown, which happened to be Durham, North Carolina. He allowed the daughter to visit her mother in Guatemala when she got older, and the mother came to Durham to visit her as well. Some years later, the father met and married Miss Roebuck, a Sears heiress from Chicago, Illinois. She fell in love with her husband's daughter and wanted to adopt her, which meant that the parental rights of the Guatemalan mother had to be severed. The Guatemalan mother did not have much money with which to afford an attorney. Through his new wife, Mr. Montaldo had more resources than almost everyone, and he could afford the very best lawyers, which he did. The mother could only attract pro bono attorneys, which would represent her for free, and they had little experience in domestic court. From 1998 to 2000, the father's attorneys filed a series of actions, including custody and termination of parental rights, against the Guatemalan mother. The mother counterclaimed for visitation and contended that she had an important role to play in her child's life. Ultimately, money won out, and the mother did not have resources to pursue the case further in court. She settled her case by giving the American father all rights to custody of the daughter, giving up her rights to visitation, and consenting to the adoption of her daughter by his new wife. To this day, I wonder if the daughter will ever see her Guatemalan mother again. I have never liked the influence of money and the impact it can have on a legal proceeding, especially if the other side lacks resources. Anyone who goes to court against another party who has a lawyer is at a substantial disadvantage, especially if the legal matter is complicated. Judges can level the playing field a little bit, but judges cannot give parties to an action legal advice, or advise them directly or indirectly how to try their case. Especially in civil and domestic cases, a party without a lawyer may not receive much justice at all. Gay rights. Courts have considered issues of gay rights in states across the country, California, Massachusetts, and New York, to name a few. But in a North Carolina district courtroom? Not a chance. Or so I thought, until two Durham gay men, Perry Ellis and his partner, sued the Durham County Register of Deeds to obtain an application for a marriage license. Surely that case won't come in front of me, I thought to myself. But if it did, I needed to be at full speed. So I looked up the Defense of Marriage Act. That state law defines marriage as between a man and a woman. So when I went to my civil courtroom one day in May of 2005, I didn't expect anything but the usual collections cases, personal injury, and automobile subrogation cases, stuff like that. Boy, was I surprised when I walked into the courtroom. I felt six microphones on top of my bench and was told that there were four television cameras in the courtroom. What is this? I asked the clerk. The gay rights case is on the calendar, she told me. No, it's not, I responded to her. It's not on the printed calendar. It was added on at the last minute, the clerk responded. It never made it to the printed calendar. Well, as Gomer Pyle used to say, surprise, surprise, surprise. I was a lucky judge chosen to hear the gay rights case. Don't get me wrong, I have always been sympathetic to gay rights. In a different kind of way, I view gay rights as being close to civil rights, though I also know it's a very different matter. The county attorney spoke first. He had filed a motion to dismiss the case and wanted to be heard. Then I heard from the plaintiffs. Sherry Patrick, a noted gay attorney in Durham, represented them. She recited the Defense of Marriage Act, but left out the critical first sentence. But I knew what the first sentence said. State law did not permit two gay men to be married. But I did not want to dismiss the case outright. There were serious constitutional issues here, like equal protection. The constitutional issues were not yet pled. So I transferred the case to Superior Court, the highest trial court in North Carolina. Superior Court could give more time for those constitutional arguments to be made. For the most part, gay men and women are just like the rest of us. Scientific studies have shown that their brains are a little different, so gay people are born that way. I also know that there are many people in North Carolina who believe that the Old Testament of the Bible speaks against homosexuality. I believe in the Bible, too. I'm a Christian, but I don't believe that every word of the Bible can be taken literally, especially in the face of scientific evidence. Gay people should have the same rights to a union that heterosexuals have. They work, live, and pay taxes just like the rest of us. So I believe they should have the same rights and responsibilities as the rest of us. When it comes to the issue of gay adoptions, I also firmly believe that gay women or gay men should have the right to adopt a child. Again, scientific studies show that gay people are just as good, or bad, at raising children as heterosexuals. Moreover, medical advances have allowed lesbian women to become pregnant through artificial insemination. Does this mean we should preclude the other partner from having the same legal rights and responsibilities to their child as the biological mother? I certainly don't believe so. Just look at it from the child's point of view. If gay adoption of the child is not allowed, the child loses the right to inheritance through the other partner, as well as Social Security death benefits should that occur. In addition, the public school system cannot formally recognize a third party as a parent absent adoption. Under these circumstances, I believe that gay adoptions make sense. Having said that, I know I probably couldn't be elected dog catcher in the state of North Carolina, but I probably could still be elected in Durham or Chapel Hill or Carrboro. But I don't much care. Awareness of the gay rights issue from a national historical perspective gives a better insight to the gay rights movement. If you recall, the Declaration of Independence made black people three-fifths of white people, and there was no mention of women at all. After the founding of the Republic, the United States fought a civil war to free the black slaves. The women's movement grew, and women were given the right to vote. They still are not regarded as equal to men, but it is much better. Likewise, the blacks fought for their civil rights and were granted the right to vote and to be treated equally with the white population. More change is needed, but the blacks have come a long way, too. As we have integrated more and more minorities into the American mainstream, a smaller minority deserves the same consideration. Gay people are not asking others to necessarily accept their choice, assuming that it is one, nor are they trying to recruit others to become gay. All that they are asking is to be treated the same way from a human rights point of view. Put more specifically, gay people want the same rights to be treated equally with the broader aspects of the American population. They just want to be treated like everybody else. Why not? In a surprising move on April 3, 2009, even my home state of Iowa recognized gay rights as I was finishing this manuscript. An article in the Des Moines Register the next day stated, quote, "Basic fairness and constitutional equal protection were the linchpins of Friday's historic Iowa Supreme Court ruling that overturned a 10-year-old ban on same-sex marriage and puts Iowa squarely in the center of the nation's debate over gay rights. The landmark ruling is guaranteed to send shockwaves through politics in Iowa and beyond," unquote. The article continues to quote one of the lawyers in this case, quote, "We won. It is unanimous. Today the dream becomes reality, and the Iowa Constitution's promise of equality is fulfilled. Iowans have never waited for others to do the right thing," unquote. I am proud to be from Iowa. One of my southern friends told me years ago that his family had come to North Carolina in the 1700s, so he still considered me a new southerner. I asked him what that term meant. He laughed and responded, A new Southerner is someone who has lived here for more than 20 years, and we like you. I believe that gay rights are only a matter of time. By a 6-to-1 margin, young adults ages 15 to 25 approve of gay rights. As time goes on, the more liberal attitudes of our young people will carry the day. When the change comes, the United States will become an even fairer country to a smaller minority of its people that deserve equality. We all do. In August 2009, the North Carolina Court of Appeals gave district court judges the discretion to grant a gay adoption that came before them. Their legal analysis was more from a parent-child approach than supporting gay rights generally. Change usually starts in a small step, and I know that the gay community will press their issue, their desire for equality, further in the years ahead. I just think it's fair to treat everyone the same unless they are convicted of violating the criminal law. The Duke Party Raid. Every fall in North Carolina, freshman students descend upon their various colleges and universities throughout the state. And every fall, the statewide alcohol law enforcement, ALE, agents raid college student parties shortly after the school year begins. And 2005 was no exception. On August 26, 2005, the first weekend of school at Duke University, the Duke Ale team was looking for some action. They found it in a large party on West Markham Avenue, directly across from East Campus. There was a student party with over 150 students going on, with likely underage alcohol consumption also going on. The Durham City Police Department took control of the perimeter around the house so that nobody could get in or out. An ALE undercover agent, Israel Morrow, dressed like a Duke student, approached the door and knocked. "Are you a Duke student?" the person who answered the door asked. The undercover agent said he was, in fact, a Duke student and was led into the party. Neither side could prove who opened the door for Morrow. Morrow walked all through the first floor of the residence and observed multiple cases, which he believed represented underage drinking. By cell phone, he directed his ALE counterparts to raid the residence. The back door was sealed off by the presence of officers. The Duke students clearly had nowhere to go. They were asked to prove how old they were. If they were under 21, they were cited for underage drinking. The ALE issued 92 citations that night, primarily for underage drinking. But there was one problem. The ALE agents had neglected to obtain a search warrant before they entered the private residence. The defendants, led by veteran Durham County constitutional lawyer Tom Laughlin, filed a motion to suppress the evidence. "Since I had substantial prior criminal law experience, I was chosen to hear this case." There was no argument about the facts of the case. They were as I described. I found that the absence of a search warrant was fatal to the state's case. The criminal magistrate's office in the Durham County Jail was only about 5 to 7 minutes from the scene. There was no evidence of any emergency or any hot pursuit of a criminal suspect. Most of the partygoers blew 0.03 or 0.04 on the breathalyzer, well below the legal limit of 0.08. So I granted the defendant's motion to suppress. The Raleigh News and Observer quoted me as saying, in allowing the defendant's motion to suppress evidence, quote, "A man's home is his castle, and that includes all members of our county, including Duke students. Constitutional rights are not technicalities. Constitutional rights are fundamental," unquote. The state dismissed all of the 92 charges brought against the Duke students. Months later, during the Duke's men lacrosse controversy, television commentator Nancy Grace chided me as being one of the judges who supported the Duke students. I laughed when I heard her. I rather thought that the requirement for law enforcement to obtain a search warrant prior to entering a private residence was fundamental black-letter law in the United States. When I last checked, it still was. Moreover, the requirement for a search warrant has been around since the early days of the Republic. I thought I was just doing my job. I wasn't a judge looking to win a popularity contest. Sometimes I learned one even gets criticized for doing the right thing. Sentencing Services, Walter Rogers. In early March 2007, I was in criminal district court hearing the plea agreement for Walter Rogers, who was charged with assault by pointing a gun. I spoke directly to the defendant, as I sometimes do, to make sure they understand what they are doing and the nature of the plea. His answers rang true, but they just didn't sound right. This is Wayne Wagner for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is designed for a print and visually impaired audience. We will continue with the book Blind Justice by Judge Craig Brown next week.